Parsha of Balak is unique, really, among the parshas of the Torah, in the sense that it doesn't involve, principally, the principal people of the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu, in terms of most of the parsha, is not active. Neither are Bnei Yisrael. It is about them, but it doesn't involve them. One can only ponder, speculate. Did any of Bnei Yisrael notice these two gentlemen, Bilam and Balak, looking at them? Had they any notion of what was being said? We find out later in the Torah. In fact, according to some Mefarshim, this is the understanding of a rather interesting statement in the Gemara in Maseches Baba Basra, in the end of the first parak, Daf Yud Dalet, which describes all of the Kisvei HaKodesh, all of the Sfarim of Tanakh, and tells us who wrote them, beginning, of course, with Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Gemara says, Moshe Kosav Sifro, he wrote, of course, Sefer Torah, the Chumash, Uparshas Bilam, and the Parsha of Bilam, and Sefer Iyov. There's a whole shaila exactly when, if Iyov lived, but the Sefer Iyov, according to the Gemara, the Sefer was written by Moshe Rabbeinu. So two of those three are understandable in the sense that Torah Tzivalanu Moshe, Moshe gave us the Chumash, and now we know that Moshe wrote Sefer Iyov. But what does the Gemara mean by saying that Moshe wrote the Parsha of Bilam? I mean, the Parsha of Bilam is in the Torah. If there's one letter from Parshas Bilam missing, the entire Sefer Torah is puzzle, as is true with any section of the Torah. Indeed, one great Rishon the Ritva, in his Perush to Baba Basra there, understands that the Gemara means to say that Moshe wrote an additional work dealing with the Parsha of Bilam in detail, much more than we have in the Torah. And in fact, there is one reading of the Gemara there that Moshe Kosav Sifro, the Sefer Bilam, which really indicates that it was an entire work in itself, an entire Sefer. Our reading is Parshas Bilam, but nonetheless, as the Ritva, this is not a reference to Parshas Balak, which is part of Torah, that's included within Sifro, within the Sefer Torah's Moshe, but rather it's a Sefer going much more in detail and in depth about all the various before, after, and during. So says the Ritva. But other Mefarshim explained that the Gemara does indeed mean to refer to Parshas Balak, and the reason why it gets a separate mention, even though it's part of the Sefer Torah, is because it really is distinct in nature from the rest of Torah in the way that we've said, that it's not about anything that Moshe does or Bnei Yisrael do. They are really being spoken about, and that's reflected in a separate mention within Sefer Torah's Moshe of the things that Moshe wrote. And if we begin, although as we will see, we do learn a great deal about Bnei Yisrael, as much as they don't do anything, through Bilam's words we learn much about them. But let's begin at the beginning, because as we will see, there are a number of important questions, mamish in the opening psukim. The parsha, as we know, begins in, well, it starts in Perik, Pasuk Beis of the Perik, Vayar Balak ben Sipor, Es kol asher asah Yisrael Amori. So Balak sees everything Yisrael did to the Amori. That's a reference to the wars mentioned at the end of last week's parsha. Sichon Melech Amori, Og Melech HaBashan, completely destroyed them, and Balak sees this. Vayagar Moab b'plei ha'am ma'od kiravhu, and Moab is afraid. Vayakatz, and also disgusted. That's an interesting combination: fear and disgust. Mipnei b'nei Yisrael. And they begin to confer, Vayomer Moab al-Zikne Midyan. Ata, Yelachachu ha-Kaholas kol sibiv oseinu, they're going to uproot everything, Kuchoch ha-Shores, Yerak ha-Sode, the way an ox does, it uproots from the root, takes from the root. U-Balak ben Sipor melech le-Moab ba-Eis ha-Hi. And Balak was the king of Moab at that time. And even just reading the psukim and trying to pay attention to them, there are a number of questions that will come up in pshat. Firstly, Balak, and the parsha is named after Balak. Who is he? Well, originally, or initially, we're not told. He's Balak. We're told who his father was. Now we know, but we don't know who he is. Vayar Balak ben Sipor. In three Psukim's time, at the end of Pasuk Dalad, we're told Balak ben Sipor, Melech Lemoab, Beisei, and Balak. Incidentally, you should know that Balak was the king of Moab. That's pertinent information. And of course, the question is, this is not the way the Torah normally presents people. Whoever is introduced, so we get his credentials, we get his CV, his resume at the time. So the pasuk we posit should have said, Vayar Balak ben Sipor, Melech Moab, Eis Kol Asher Asa Yisrael Emori. It seems to have been filled in as an afterthought. Kings don't like to be filled in as afterthoughts. So what is behind this lag, in a sense, of giving us the full credentials of Balak? We should also note that the first pasuk tells us what Balak saw. Vayar Balak ben Sipor. Okay, but it does not tell us how he reacted. It does tell us how Moab reacted. Vayagar Moab mipnei ha'am. But it doesn't tell us what Moab saw. So it's interesting, as the subjects of the psukim change. Balak saw what happened, Moab is afraid, and Moab actually is the one that instigates the message to Midian. In Pasuk Dalet, Vayomer Moab el ziknei Midian. What about Balak? He seems to be somewhat passive, which is unusual for a king. King is meant to lead. And finally, there's a shifting in terminology in as far as how Yisrael themselves are referred to. Really, from Pasuk to Pasuk. And in the first Pasuk, they are called Yisrael. Vayar Balak ben Sipor es kol asher asa Yisrael lo emori. Then, in the next Pasuk, when it talks about the fear of Moab, it says, Vayagar Moab mipnei ha'am ma'od. Well, which am? The am. Yisrael. But it doesn't call them Yisrael, even though it did in the first Pasuk. It shifted to call them the am, but then goes on to say, Vayakotz Moab mipnei b'nei Yisrael. So they are referred to again as b'nei Yisrael, but only in the second phrase of that second pasuk, which is about the disgust that Moab felt for whatever reason, but not in the first phrase, which is about their fear. So we've fluctuated. We've gone from Yisrael to the Am and back to Yisrael, and as we can appreciate, kol zeh omer darsheni. And there are many, many ways of understanding these opening psukim, but I would like to present the way the Alshich understand. Very interesting, of course, the Alshich, one of his trademarks, are these this attention to detail, all of these questions. Nothing goes unnoticed by the Alshich. It's his minhag to open with a slew of kashas. They can number in the 20s or the 30s, and then you have to get through them to finally find out what the answer is. And the basis of, or the principle of what the Alshich is saying, is that Balak and Moab both really are in a similar situation. They're under threat, so to speak, from B'nai Yisrael. But they do not interpret or judge the threat in the same way at all. And in order to understand why, we need to appreciate that Balak, out of everyone else, he saw firsthand what happened in the war between Yisrael and the Amori. We'll find out, I mean, we're told later on that he was the king of Moab at that time. Earlier on, he was not the king of Moab. The Yalkut Shimoni tells us that he was actually originally an Amori officer, and he was in the war. And in fact, that's why the Pasuk says, Vayar Balak ben Sipor es kol asher asa Yisrael Emori. He saw it. He was there. Kli Rishon, as they say. And he witnessed it firsthand. That was before he became the king of Moab. And in fact, that's the reason why the Pasuk in this opening words does not refer to him as Balak, the king of Moab, because it's talking about what he saw before he was the king of Moab, while he was yet with the Amori. It's just Moab panicked, and they didn't have a king that could do anything. They chose someone with experience. They chose Balak, they took him from the Amori and asked if he would be their king. Ba'esahi, at that time, it's an emergency measure. But initially, Balak sees himself what happened. And the question is, what did he see? He saw something that if you didn't see it, you wouldn't believe it. And that is that the way that Yisrael won the war was a way that no one else ever won a war. The way a war is won is basically, certainly in those days, the one with the bigger army wins the war. I mean, that's the minhag. And here's Balak, and he sees that there is a much higher power operating on behalf of Bnei Yisrael. There were not that many of them relative to the Amori. It wasn't about the numbers, but rather it was about something else entirely. And that's why, but he can't necessarily explain it, but he knows that there's something about Yisrael, there's something elevated about them. They won the war, and they could win another one. And that's why, as we know, the two terms, Yisrael and the Am, always have this connotation when they're juxtaposed together. Namely, that Yisrael represents the higher levels, the higher echelons, or the higher madrega of Bnei Yisrael, and the Am, in a sense, is much more generic, and it's less distinct and less descript, sometimes the lower levels, and sometimes just the people generally. And that's why, if you didn't see it, you wouldn't believe it, but what Balak saw is Kol Asher Asah Yisrael Emori. He saw Yisrael in action. There's thing unusual about Bnei Yisrael. Whatever it is, it works, and it defeated the Emori. That's Balak. However, as we stated, if you didn't see it, you wouldn't believe it, and no one from Moab saw it, which means they didn't believe it. The only thing that Moab knows for a fact is that the Amori were defeated. But the question is, well, what do they ascribe it to? What do they put it down to? How could they explain it? They explain it the way they explain every type of military victory. There must have been more of the Jews than there were of the Amori. And that's a classic, people still make that mistake about the Jewish people. If you don't know that many, you're quite sure there's many more of them than there actually are. I mean, there have to be. Many things that couldn't really be explained otherwise. And that's why the second Pasuk gives us the reaction of Moab. They were afraid. But who were they afraid of? They're not afraid of Yisrael. They don't see the unusual nature of the Jewish people as something to be afraid of. They were afraid mipnei ha'am ma'od. But they're afraid of this enormous nation that they imagine must be there. Ki ravhu, there's many of them. That's how they explain the victory. What about the unique nature of Bnei Yisrael? That wasn't a source of fear for them. That was just a source of revulsion. They don't like the Jewish people to be that way. But they're not afraid of them for that. And that's why the pasuk continues, Vayakatz Moav mipnei Bnei Yisrael. Their reaction to Bnei Yisrael was Vayakatz, just to be, they didn't like it. They were disdainful of it, but not fearful of it. Now, depending on your understanding of how Bnei Yisrael won the first war will determine how you think they might win the second war against you, which will then determine what protective measures you're going to take. And here we see that Balak and Moab part ways. Because they differ in their understanding of the nature of the threat, they also differ in their understanding as to the measure of the solution. And so, in keeping with their approach, Moab, that it's about numbers, so if they may threaten you because of numbers, so what's the solution to that? Get more numbers. And that's why the first thing Moab does is form an alliance. That's an initiative of Moab, as described in Pasuk Dalet. Vayomer Moab al-Ziknei, you've got to get together. Safety in numbers. Moab could be outnumbered. Moab and Midian have a better chance. It's all about figures. But as we mentioned, Balak is not part of that initiative because he's seen that it's not about numbers at all. You want to band together with another nation, it's not going to make a difference. If we could quote the poetic modern Hebrew phrase, Chaval al Hazman, it's a waste of time. It doesn't make a difference. Balak has his own understanding, much closer to the truth. as to what's the secret of the success of Bnei Yisrael, they have some spiritual power working for them, and therefore the antidote, as far as Balak is concerned, is a counter-spiritual force. He's the one that sends the message to Bilam in Pasuk Hey, Vayishlach Malachim El Bilam Ben Baor. If the problem is one of Ruchnius, if the threat is one of Ruchnius, the solution will be, at least on a Ruchnius plane, not on a holy plane, on an anti-holy plane, and that's the entry of Bilam into the equation. So the analysis of the Al Shecha Kodesh, and as we said, it begins as always by paying close attention to all of these questions: the Am, Yisrael, Moab, Balak, timing, when are we told who he is, etc., and so forth. And as is always the case, through the Gedolei Hadoros, the more we pay attention to these things, the more we leave each of these sections Beruchush Gadol with a greater understanding of what the Torah means to say. Now, I'd like to move now to the Parsha of Bilam himself, and to focus on one or two important lessons that the Parsha teaches us about Bnei Yisrael. And one could certainly say that that's one of the primary goals of this Parsha. Bilam, he persists in his request to curse Bnei Yisrael. Initially, Hashem says no. Subsequently, Hashem says yes, under certain circumstances. Bilam, of course, doesn't read the small print and proceeds to with his own plans. But as the Aruch Haim HaKadosh explains, after all, it's a difficult situation. The first time Hashem says no, and the second time he says okay, to a certain degree. I mean, did he change his mind? Or what does that mean? But the Aruch Haim HaKadosh explains that there's dynamics here, in the sense that, of course, Hashem will say no the first time, because the answer is no, you shouldn't do it. But at a certain point, it's important that Bilam shouldn't think that Hashem doesn't want him to go, perhaps because he's afraid of Bilam, and therefore, as he persists, it's also important for people to realize, and Bilam pays the highest price of everyone, you know, he leaves in disgrace, that Hashem is not afraid of him, and he can do his best or do his worst. In the end, it won't make a difference. So, and that he learnt the hard way. As he's leaving, so the Pasuk describes in Pasuk Kaf Dalet, the donkey has this encounter with the Malach. Bilam only realizes that later on. And the first time it just kind of veers off and goes in all different directions, which upsets Bilam. The second time, Vayamod Malach Hashem b'mishol hakramim, gader mizeh v'gader mizeh. The second encounter or confrontation, the Malach is there in this path in the vineyards, gader mizeh v'gader mizeh. There's a wall or a fence on either side. Interestingly, the Medrash Tanchuma gives us the background to this wall. I mean, have we met this wall before? We have, actually. And the background to this background is a statement of the Gemara in Sanhedrin in Daf Kuf Hei, which tells us that of Bilam's yichus, for want of a better word, Bilam was descended from Lavan. It's from Aram Naharaim. He's a descendant of Lavan. We should mention, it is important to note, the Targum Yonus of Ben Uziel in Parshas Kisavo actually goes so far as to identify Bilam as Lavan. But as Rabbi Yaakov Emden points out, that may be the Targum's way of saying that he is descended from Lavan, as often is the case. He has so much in common with them, he's basically the same person, but a number of generations down the line, it's possible, it's not impossible, that he's actually Lavan. One can never really know about these things, but he is from Lavan. So, the last time Lavan met Yaakov, they made a pact of non-aggression. And the way that they did that was they put a pile of stones together, known as Gal-Aid, if you're Yaakov, Yegar Sadusa, if you're Lavan, and that was the sign of their covenant between each other, that they would not harm each other. Well, Bilam is on his way to violate that covenant in the classic tradition of people that make pacts with the Jewish people, and therefore, as he passes by this Gal-Aid, he gets a bit of a reminder, and really what he is up to is no good, and his foot gets crushed, etc. That's the Gal Eid set up all those years ago. The way the Pasuk describes it is Gader Mizeh V'Gader Mizeh. And the Medrash has a fascinating comment on this obviously very striking phrase, Gader Mizeh V'Gader Mizeh. Because Mizeh and Mizeh has already featured in the Torah, where the Luchos that were given to Bnei Yisrael were written on both sides. The Pasuk says, Mizeh u'Mizeh heim ksuvim. And so, says the Medrash, Ataba la'akor uma, you're making a mistake, you're trying to destroy a nation, shekiblu Torah, they've received the Torah, Aleh ne'amar, Mizeh u'Mizeh heim ksuvim, they already covered Mizeh u'Mizeh, they have the Luchos, were written on both sides. And therefore, as he's on his way to try and damage them, he's also surrounded on both sides, Mizeh u'Mizeh. And the question is, what specifically is the message that comes out from this Medrash? Generally, we understand that the point of the Medrash is, they have the Torah, because they have the Torah, they're connected to an infinitely higher power than you, you won't be able to harm them, they have the Luchos, Mizeh u'Mizeh, You're wasting your time with trying to curse them. That's communicated through Mizeh u'Mizeh. But perhaps there's more. And indeed, as we will see, there is. Because we should always note, whenever the Medrash makes these comments, why would it choose to focus on seemingly a lesser aspect of the, or less central aspect of the Torah? Of all the things one could say about the Torah, there may be a number 88 is that there was written on both sides, but that should come to characterize the Torah in terms of this discussion. Apparently there's something about the fact that the Torah is written on both sides that's pertinent here, and that's what we should be trying to find out. Interestingly, the very fact that the Luchos were written on both sides itself, before we get to Bilam, just the Luchos themselves, it also needs to be understood. What is gained, if we may ask, by writing the Luchos on both sides? Presumably, most people read them from the front. You can imagine someone went behind and wanted to see what they looked like from behind, so then he also saw the Luchos. I mean, that's for him, they're written on both sides. I mean, this is a major miracle. Actually, the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos in Daf Kuf Dalad explains or formulates this miracle. They're written on both sides, says the Gemara, Nikra'im Bifnim V'Nikra'im Bachutz. That means that they could be read inside and could be read outside. Now, that itself also needs to be understood, because in what way are the two sides of the Luchos called inside and outside? I mean, there are two sides, but neither is in and neither is out. So what exactly does that mean? Well, there's a very interesting comment which I'd like to preface with, which I saw quoted in the from the Zohar Kodosh about Bilam and Balak. And that is, says the Zohar, if you look at Bilam and Balak, you will see that they are carriers for another force. The complete antithesis of Am Yisrael is Amalek, and Amalek is actually carried by Bilam and Balak. How so? Well, if you look at Bilam, his name ends with Ayin and Mem. If you look at Balak, his name ends with Lamed and Kuf, and therefore between the two of them, they're actually carriers for Amalek. The question is, of course, we meet a statement like that, we have no idea what to do with it. What's the message here? That's number one. In other words, we would think that Bilam and Balak, they're bad enough just as themselves, even if they don't represent someone else. And secondly, it's a very interesting idea that Amalek somehow can be broken up into two. Because what does half of Amalek look like? And am maybe somehow is a word, even though it's not, you know, any am is an am. And lake isn't really any word, so because amalika really isn't a word, it's just it's a name that we're not aware of any meaning, and it's so therefore a name that has no meaning. You split it in half. In what way do we say that Bilam is the carrier for the first half of amalik and Balak for the second half? That's a worthy question if we are talking about it. And the Shemi Shmuel of Sokachov explains that actually amalik is descriptive. The word Amalek is characteristic. That's number one. And number two, not only is the word Amalek characteristic, but Amalek does actually contain within it two halves, and one of them is characterized by the word Am, and the other lake, as we will see. For what is Amalek really? Amalek wishes to, in a sense, shed itself of any notion of divine supervision. They're fans of Mikra, they're proponents of chaos, of just things just happen. They don't like the notion that there's in any way type of interaction from higher realms, and they're prepared to go to war over that. They have no problem with the existence of God, just not with his involvement in the world, because that means that they're accountable for their behavior. They don't wish to be accountable for their behavior, and they spearhead, in a sense, the will. The person should be able to do whatever he wants without accountability to anyone. The only question is, well, what if you're aware that there's someone there? What do you do about that? Well, the answer is, you become unaware. And this is an interesting faculty, because recognizing that something's there doesn't mean you can't make it disappear. You can make it disappear by refusing to recognize it. That's a human trait. One could term it a dimming on demand. You can dim your consciousness to whatever you don't wish to recognize, and then it may as well not exist. These two stages of number one, shutting out any cognizance of awareness of God in this world, and number two, proceeding to act however you would like, those two stages are represented by the words Am and Lake. How so? Well, the word Am, the primary translation of the word Am, is nation, of course, but the word Am has another meaning. For the word Am also means to dim. Amum is dim, as it says in Eicha, Eicha you Am Zahav. How could it be that the gold was dimmed? So therefore, Am represents the idea of dimming, which is stage number one, of dimming awareness of Hashkocha in the world. And that allows for stage two, which is called lake. Now, what is the word lake a word? It is a word. In Sefer Shoftim, in Perek Zion, we have the war with Gidon against the Midianim. He originally gathers together quite a sizable force, and Hashem tells him, you won't need that many people. And the way to whittle down those that will go home by those that will stay is he tells them to take a drink. They should all take a drink in the, well, I hesitate to say in the lake, but in the water. And depending on how they drink, that determines whether they're fit for this battle. And it says as follows, Pasuk Hey, Vayored es ha'am el hamayim. So Gidon leads them all down to the water. Vayomer Hashem el Gidon, Kol asher yalok bilshono mil hamayim. Anyone who licks up or laps up the water with his tongue, ka asher yalok hakelev, tatzig oto levad. Anyone who drank like a dog does, put him aside, he's not going forward. The people that drink like a mensch, they're the ones that will go forward. Says the Shemi Shmuel, we see that the word lake refers to essentially eating or drinking like a dog, like an animal. And that is, in a sense, the goal of Amalek. Stage one is Am, to dim any sensibilities to the contrary, sense of accountability, and which paves the way, allows the way forward for stage two, which is lake. They can basically act the way they want. That is his explanation of how Amalek can be split up into two. Very interesting. And moreover, as we come back to our parsha, we will see how it is that Bilam and Balak represent, in a sense, embody those two stages, not in terms of their personal behavior, but in terms of their relationship nationally to the Jewish people. Because Balak also wishes to do whatever damage he can to Bnei Yisrael. He just has a problem. They're being protected by a higher power. That he knows. They're Yisrael. Is there any way that the light of divine supervision can be dimmed for them, can be withheld from them, can be restricted from them? To that end, he contracts Bilam, because Bilam has the capacity, in his estimation, and perhaps he really did to a certain degree, were it not for divine intervention on that score, that Bilam has the capacity, in a sense, to distance HaKadosh Baruch Hu from Bnei Yisrael, or them from him, and leave them vulnerable. That's called Am. That's the Am of Amalek. He dims the light of Hashem's supervision on Bnei Yisrael. In so doing, Balak can then step in and do with them as he wishes, Kasher Yalok HaKelev. So this is the Shem Shmuel's fascinating explanation as to what the Zohar Kodesh means when it says that Bilam and Balak were carriers of, in a sense, the two component parts of Amalek itself. But there is another aspect to the to Amalek, which I think is relevant here, and this is discussed by the Sefer Afike Yehuda. We find that Amalek, when they attack Bnei Yisrael, it's often emphasized that they did so in what's called Baderech. As we say in the Leining for Zohar, Asher Korcha Baderech, and in the Haftarah for Zohar, when Shmuel instigates the next war against Amalek, Asher Somlo Baderech, somehow it's very much of the essence that it was Baderech. Well, there may be many ways to understand why, but the Afike Yehuda explains. Even Amalek has a sense of, and this for us, we're not used to this, but even Amalek, who aren't interested in Hashem's supervision of the world, they have a notion of the spiritual makeup of the world. I mean, that's the whole realms of all spiritual forces, even people that aren't interested in mitzvahs, is something that they're very much aware of at that time. Every nation has its tsar, every nation has its mazel, every nation has its place, every nation has its spiritual overseer, and that in a sense is the spiritual natural makeup of the world. And the Jewish people have Eretz Yisrael. And so now the question is, what is the nature of the relationship between the Jewish people and Eretz Yisrael? It's an important question, because is it like all those other nations, that when they're on location, then they are connected to their spiritual force? If you would take them off location, perhaps there's no connection anymore. That's not true. That's a terrible mistake. What does being an Eretz Yisrael give Am Yisrael? It enhances the relationship between us and Hashem immeasurably. Immeasurably. But the fundamental question as to whether the relationship is still there if the Bnei Yisrael are not in Eretz Yisrael, so that certainly we're still connected. That, in a sense, is the chiddush of our relationship with Hashem. We're Jews without borders in that respect. And in fact, because at the end of the day, our relationship with Hashem fundamentally is based on the Torah. That's why the Torah was not given in Eretz Yisrael. It's given essentially in the middle of nowhere. Lelamedcha, that should you ever be in the middle of nowhere, but you're still connected through the Torah, but that's the basis of the relationship. When we receive the Torah, Moshe says to Bnei Yisrael, Hayom hazeh yesala'am, Lashem lokecha. Now you are a nation to Hashem. If you have the Torah, you're a nation to Hashem. If you're in Eretz Yisrael, to enhance to the nth degree. But that's a question of more, not a question of yes and no. Amalek, however, refusing to recognize that there's anything beyond the way these things normally work, it's clear to him, if the Jewish people are headed to Eretz Yisrael, so then that's their place, and that's when their force will be there for them. If he attacks them on the way, they're vulnerable. And that's why the derech is so much of the essence here. Because if they're off location, so then the relationship is off. But that, of course, is not the case. And the aspect of the Torah which reflects that it's not the case is the fact that the Luchos were written Mizeh u'Mizeh, from this side and that side. We ask the question, why do they need to be written on both sides? Write them on one side and everyone look at the same side. But we remind ourselves that the Gemara told us when they're written Mizeh u'Mizeh, that means Nikra'im Bifnim v'Nikra'im Bachutz. They can be read inside and they can be read outside. And our question was, inside where and outside where? The answer, says Afike Yehuda, is inside Eretz Yisrael and outside Eretz Yisrael. Lest B'nai Yisrael ever think that even should they be outside of Eretz Yisrael, there is a Torah, but it's only really facing inside. It's written on both sides. Nikra'im Bifnim v'Nikra'im Bachutz. And that underscores and emphasizes the universal relationship fundamentally between us and Hashem. And that's why, as Bilam, again a carrier for Amalek, he's looking for the Am of Amalek, as Bilam is looking to inflict damage on B'nai Yisrael, subscribing seemingly to the thesis of Amalek, whereby if they're not yet on location, I'll be able to damage them. And he is met by Gader Mizeh and Gader Mizeh, which is a symbol to him, a signal to him that the Jewish people are fundamentally connected, vouchsafed from your damage, from your curses, because they're connected to the Torah. Mizeh u'Mizeh. Maybe they are bachutz, but the luchos are still facing them, and that ultimately is the basis of the relationship between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's interesting to note, as a PS in this regard, that this mistake was subscribed to later on in history by B'nai Yisrael. For when Haman, who somehow gets entry into the Purim story, even though he's from Amalek and it's in Golas of Persia, Esther hears all about it, and she sends a message to Mordechai, as you remember from the Megillah, Vatitaveh Mordechai, Ladas Mazeh Ve'al Mazeh. And the Medrash explains that what Esther is asking is, well, maybe they violated the Luchos, about which it is said, Mizeh u'Mizeh Heim Ksuvim. And Mordechai answers, Vayagad la Mordechai is called Asher Karahu. And Karahu is a watchword for Amalek, Asher Karcha Baderech. How is one the answer to the other? So the Afike Yehuda explains that Esther is wondering, I mean, the Jewish people, have they let themselves go? How could it be? They don't think they're Jewish anymore? How can they be so lax? It must be they've gotten out of practice of keeping Torah in Chutz Laaretz, because they've been in Eretz Yisrael for hundreds and hundreds of years. And therefore they've grown to subscribe perhaps to the idea that Torah is primarily for Eretz Yisrael when they find themselves in Chutz Laaretz. So they unsubscribe. And that's why she says, Mazeh v'al Mazeh, perhaps they violated the Mizeh u'Mizeh factor. Is that the case? And the answer is, it is the case. Because that's how Amalek can return. If he's empowered by the Jewish people, if they subscribe to Amalek's thesis, they empower Amalek. And that's why he responds with the word Eskol Asher Kohu. In a sense, part of the recovery in the Purim story, having made that mistake, is to unmake that mistake and to establish fundamentally that the relationship itself between us and Hashem is everywhere, wherever we may be. So, this is the very beautiful interpretation of the Afike Yehuda on that Medrash, and again, it teaches us to pay attention to so many details. If it refers to the Torah with the words Mizeh u'Mizeh, it means it's the element of Mizeh u'Mizeh of the Torah that's of the essence here, as he proceeds to explain. So I'd like to spend our remaining time, I would say, by raising perhaps one of the most basic questions about Bilam, and that is, what was Bilam thinking? He seems to have rushed headlong into disgrace. And for someone who's very conscious of his kavod, he must have had some way of feeling that he could succeed in cursing B'nai Yisrael. What could that possibly be? After all, they're B'nai Yisrael, and Hashem says no, and still he thinks yes. We should also note that when we see the brachos, and the center really of Parshas Balak is the brachos of Bilam, there is an ongoing, in a sense, double layer within the psukim of dual references to Yaakov on the one hand and Yisrael on the other. We find it all over the place. It says Lo hibit oven be Yaakov v'lo ra'a amal be Yisrael. Matovu alecha Yaakov mishkanasecha Yisrael. Darakachav mi Yaakov v'kam shevet mi Yisrael. And numerous other places, it's really split up in that way. What is the understanding of those two separate references? And at the end of the day, it's the Jewish people. Well, we should remind ourselves that the term Ha'am, as opposed to Yisrael, Ha'am has this very general feel to it, whereby it's not about anyone particularly distinct on a particularly high level. It's about the lower levels, really. As Rashi told us, that even the word Ha'am could have a negative connotation, people whose behavior perhaps is a bit lacking. And we note that at the beginning of the Parsha, there is no reference neither in Balak's words or Bilam's words to cursing Yisrael, but only to cursing the Am. Hinei Ha'am Hayotzei Mimitzrayim. L'cha'or li es Ha'am Hazeh. Perhaps, therefore, we may understand that Bilam thought, well, if it's Yisrael, there's nothing to talk about. If they merit, perhaps they're beyond his reach. But there's so many of the Jewish people that have less merits. They're called the Am. Perhaps there he can inflict damage. Orali as Ha'am. And in a sense, the Chiddush, which Bilam did not fully really accept, the Chiddush that Hashem told him is, Lo ta'or es Ha'am ki baruchu, the entire nation is baruch. He didn't relate to that, because why should they be baruch if their behavior is perhaps less than it should be? So it sounds at this stage, as the only group within the Jewish people that Bilam could realistically hope to damage is called the Am. Yisrael, he has no hope. The higher level called Yisrael, he has no hope. Actually, however, we will see that even for Yisrael, the higher level, he had designs, but they were significantly different. There's a well-known statement in the Gemara, in two places in Brachas and Daf Zayin, Avodah Zarah, Daf Dalet, about a certain talent that Bilam had. He had a certain sense of timing. The way that the Gemara describes it is that every day Hashem gets angry for one moment. Ki rega ba'apo. So the Gemara asks, well, how long is a rega? And the Gemara answers, the amount of time it takes to say the word rega, that's it. So, and says the Gemara, had and knew when that time was. And if Hashem had gotten angry, so to speak, clearly that's a euphemism, but if those forces of din were brought to bear at that moment, Bilam really would have been able to wreak great destruction and great damage against Yisrael. The chesed was that Hashem did not get angry in those days, which upset the cosmic balance, in a sense, but it was done for Bnei Yisrael. Tosfos, interestingly, asked the question, because you have to ask, and that's Tosfos' job, never to get carried away and forget to ask these things. If it only asks a rega, so how much can you say in a rega? By the time you say rega, it's finished. By the time you clear your throat, you've lost your chance. So Tosfos say you could choose a very short word, which just means destroy them, like kalem, and that's that, destroy them. Or perhaps, says Tosfos, it's about when you start. If you start at the right moment, so then your way is clear. Interesting tirutzim of Tosfos. But what's important to realize is, this is very different. What we seem to be talking about is, the Parsha seems to be discussing, he's cursing Bnei Yisrael. Along comes the Gemara and says he's waiting for a moment. It sounds like when you miss that moment, there's nothing to do until this time tomorrow. However, one of the classic Sfarim, Pirushim on the Torah from the earlier Acharonim, is the Sefer Binyan Ariel, from Rav Shaul of Amsterdam. He was, I think, a brother-in-law or a cousin of Rabbi Yaakov Emden, so he's there in the early 1700s. It's a very special sefer. And the Binyan Ariel says, this, when the Gemara says that he was waiting for this moment, that's in order to inflict damage on the higher level called Yisrael. Because at that moment of anger, everyone is susceptible to damage. When the full din is brought to bear, even Yisrael are potentially in danger. And therefore, says the Binyan Ariel, when you have Bilam, he wants to curse the Jewish people. So for the Am, in his estimation, he doesn't need to wait for that moment. I mean, he can curse them at any time of the day because they have enough problems, and perhaps he can find a hook. It's specifically with regards to Yisrael that he needs to wait for that moment. That's a big chiddush, but actually, it's explicit in the pasuk. For let's have a look in Perek Kaf Gimel Pasuk Zayin. This is the opening of his first nevuah, of his first bracha, and he says, Perek Kaf Gimel Pasuk Zayin, Vayisam Mishalo Vayomar Min Aram Yancheni Balak Melech Moav Mehar Rekedem. Balak has he is called, he is invited, and said, and now let's see these words, Lecha Ora Li Yaakov. Ulecha Zoama Yisrael. Here, this is the first time that Bilam makes reference to two groups. Well, makes two references because they are two groups, Yaakov and Yisrael. And as we know and mentioned before, Yaakov, relative to Yisrael, is the lower level, Yisrael is the higher level. And the question is, well, what's the program for these two groups? Is it homogenous? Is it the same? It's not the same. Because look at what the program is for each of these two. For Yaakov, it says, Lecha orally Yaakov, to curse Yaakov. When? Whenever. Doesn't specify. As far as Bilam is concerned, any time they could be susceptible to damage. When it comes to Yisrael, it says, Ulecha zo'amo Yisrael. Za'am. As the pasuk says, "V'keil zo'aim b'chol yom." That's the source of this idea that Hashem gets angry, so to speak, every day. It's from that pasuk, "V'keil zo'aim b'chol yom." Ulecha zam o Yisrael is to capitalize on that moment of zam. For Yisrael, you have to wait for that moment. And therefore, we see it's a fascinating, in a sense, breakdown of these psukim that actually. Whereas we would say generally that Bilam wanted to harm the Jewish people, there were actually two tiers and two different avenues through which he sought to harm them. For Yaakov, the lower level, to curse them generally. For Yisrael, the higher level, to find that moment of Za'am. So with regards to Yisrael, Hashem didn't get angry during those moments, so Yisrael are safe. But what about the Am? Well, in a sense, the surprise that was waiting for Bilam was that even the Am, the lower level, who perhaps may not be able to make it through on their own merit, are still blessed because they are part of the nation called Yaakov. And moreover, and this actually brings us to a famous formulation of Rav Huttner Zatzal in the Pachad Yitzchak, in Chanukah, and another few places, where essentially the concept of Jewishness assembled as the Avos happened. That is to say, Avram brought a certain concept of Jewishness, Yitzhak added, and Yaakov added to that. And by that we mean, Avram was the first person to become Jewish, to whatever means to be Jewish at that time. Yitzhak added a further chiddush. It's possible to be born Jewish. Avram wasn't born Jewish, but Yitzhak was. So what's the chiddush of Yaakov? Once you're born Jewish, so then where do you go from there? But there was a chiddush of Yaakov. And that is that in the times of Avram and Yitzhak, someone who was born Jewish did not necessarily stay Jewish. Someone who was born as part of that family was not guaranteed that they would not exit. And both had children that did. Yishmael was descended from Avram. He was exited the program. Esav is descended from Yitzhak. He was born as Jewish as Yaakov was at birth, and he exited. The chiddush of Yaakov was that the Jewishness by heritage is so thorough that there is no exit. That means that no one ever falls to the way, never fundamentally, never completely. We mentioned at the time, this actually was the basis of the fear of Yosef's brothers, that they didn't realize that was the chiddush of their generation. They'd seen what happened to their great uncle Yishmael, they saw what happened to their uncle Esav, and they felt that they were next, because Yosef, through the things he was saying about them, perhaps would lead to them being deleted from the program. They took what they felt were measures of self-defense. But actually, at that time already, no one would ever be ejected from Yisrael. And therefore, in a sense, the answer to Bilam's goals for the Am is Yaakov. That's a chiddush called Yaakov. That Yaakov means that even those that are on the lower level, they're still part of the Jewish people. And indeed, the Aruch Laner, in his drushas, explains that's why, when even though Yaakov's name was changed to Yisrael, he never dropped the name Yaakov. Because his descendants need him to remain Yaakov. That port needs to remain open for all of those who are on the level analogous to Yaakov amongst his descendants to still claim descendancy from the Avos. And on the contrary, the Aruch Laner is a fascinating explanation of the victory of Yaakov over the angel, where the angel calls him Yisrael. And we look at that and it, you know, warms the heart. Esav's angel calls him Yisrael. It's such a nice moment. Finally recognizes, says the Aruch Laner, no, the angel wanted Yaakov to become Yisrael completely. Because if he's no longer Yaakov, then any of his descendants who are on the level of Yaakov have no father. It's a damaging act to the angel. On the contrary, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu later on changes his name to Yisrael, it begins by emphasizing that your name is still Yaakov. Shimcha Yaakov. But your name is also Yisrael. In a sense, not endorsing what Esav's angel, the name change. Undoing the name change. It will not fully happen yet because your descendants still need you to be Yaakov. And this gives us further insight into the Medrash quoted by Rashi as Bilam has all of his escapades with the donkey, and it's going this way and that way, and there are three points of encounter, three points of confrontation. And Rashi says there's three points of confrontation because Simone Avos Herolo. He had these three points where things didn't go his way because he's coming up against the Jewish people descended from the Avos. Except it's very interesting to note that the nature of what happened with the donkey changes with each time. Because the angel is there, but the first time round the donkey takes a detour, but he veers off the path, which is not glut, but he keeps going in a sense. And that represents Avram, because even if they're descended from Avram, but Bilam could still keep going, because not all of Avram's children were immune to spiritual damage. And then he keeps going. And the second time round, Gader Mizeh, it's a squeeze. And this is Yitzchak, but he can make it through. Because Yitzchak also had Esav, and maybe there's some Esavs amongst the Jewish people. But the final confrontation is Yaakov, and the donkey just stops. He can't move forward. And that represents the fact there are no exits when it comes to Yaakov, because Yaakov means that anyone descended from Yaakov is absolutely part of the Jewish people, always and unconditionally, and therefore there's no way forward. At that point, one could say, in a sense, that what Bilam is battling against during this parsha is he's battling against that development which is called Yaakov. It's and interestingly, one may add, you can never know, but if Bilam is descended from Lavan or is Lavan in some degree, so it's interesting to note when was his last point of contact with Yaakov. His direct contact with Yaakov was when Yaakov came to him, having taken the brachos and the bechorah away from Esav, who got deleted from the program, and that was his introduction to Yaakov. So and you could almost say that he's looking to get back to the Alte Gezeiten, where things the way they used to be, back in the good old days, where if you didn't make the grade, you got pushed to the side. And there's a lot of Jewish people like that. He's not prepared. He's not updated. He doesn't want to get with the times. That once Yaakov's children, there's no one like that anymore. And we can see this, interestingly, by the korbanos that he brings. Bilam brings korbanos, which itself is such a mystifying thing. He thinks that will help him to bring korbanos. And what does he bring? On each korban he brings, par va'ayil, a cow and a ram. Now, there's actually one korban missing that normally would go together to complete the trio of korbanos. There's no kvasim. There's no sheep. There's par, the isle. What are we to make of that? Says the Vilna Gaon in the Aderes Eliyahu. If you look in Parshas Pinchas, in Rashi towards the end, you will see that Rashi explains that these three types of korban, these three types of animal, par, isle, and keves, correspond to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Avram is par, vel ha-bakar ratz Avraham. Yitzchak is isle, the Akedah, and Yaakov is keves, vakvasim, hifrid Yaakov. And therefore, we see something very interesting. In a sense, Bilam is looking to bring korbanos corresponding to Avram and Yitzchak, and not Yaakov. In a sense, you could say he's looking to subscribe to the way things were spiritually with Avram and Yitzchak. He's on board with how Avram and Yitzchak, and deliberately leaving out Yaakov, because he doesn't want the development of Yaakov, because then no one can be harmed by him. That's what's behind the bringing of Par Va'ayel specifically. He's a big advocate of Avram and Yitzchak's way, not so much of Yaakov's way. At the end of the day, and at his great expense to him and his covered and all of that, he was forced to admit that the entire Jewish people were beyond his reach. They're all part of Am Hashem. But because his critical error was in the echelons of the Jewish people that are known as Yaakov, that is why all of his brachas and all of his positive descriptions make specific reference to a group called Yaakov. He doesn't group the Jewish people together. He's saying such and such is true for Yisrael, and such is also true for Yaakov. They may be not the same level of Yisrael, but ultimately they're the same. He needs to sing the praises of that group called Yaakov, because they were the ones that he was really after. But at the end of the day, they may not be Yisrael, but they're certainly in process, in progress, and they're part of that group, Matovo Alecha Yaakov, as well as Mishkan Osecha Yisrael, as well as all of the other brachos. So as we mentioned, Bnei Yisrael are not described here as doing anything specifically, but there's a great deal to learn about Bnei Yisrael and Bnei Yaakov, if we may say, from the words of Bilam himself. We'll leave it for the next